The conflict has been raging since 2021 with devastating consequences for people of Myanmar and far-reaching implications for regional security.
The tide of war appears to be turning against the Myanmar military regime.
And within the space of a few days, several towns, district-level towns, border, the more strategic locations along the trade route with China, these were captured.
Before we get into today's show, I'd like to take a moment to invite you to share your thoughts and opinions on our work. If you have feedback, ideas, or suggestions regarding any part of our overall platform, we'd love to hear from you. Please don't hesitate to reach out. We're listening. Your insights help us to grow and ensure that we're making the greatest impact possible. To share your thoughts, go to insightmyanmar.org/feedback.
Anthony Davis, thank you for sitting down and joining us one more time on this episode of Inside Myanmar Podcast.
My pleasure.
This is the third time we've had the pleasure of being able to have your voice and your insights on our podcast. I would expect that many of our listeners are familiar with you from your extensive work and writing, as well as your previous experiences. But as we always do, I'd like to invite you to give a brief introduction for those that are hearing you the first time.
Well, I'll make it very brief. My background is in security. I've been based here in Bangkok since 1979. I've been looking at Myanmar on and off, and in the early years, probably more off than on, since 1980, when I spent time with the Karen National Liberation Army for several weeks in their area of operations when it was a very different war. But for most of the 80s and 90s, my focus was on Afghanistan rather than Southeast Asia. And I spent a lot of time there. And I suppose that was in many ways my, not so much an introduction, but that was where I became pretty familiar with the requirements and the reality of guerrilla warfare close up. So that was an education. And I became, by virtue of having to walk around in those days, a lot of northern Afghanistan and central Afghanistan, I became very familiar with the country, and it's always been a part of who I am ever since. However, fast forward to where we are today, I've been getting back into Myanmar work, largely since the collapse of the ceasefire regime with the military's invasion of Kokang in August, September 2009, which then led into a whole series of Tatmadaw campaigns against the Kachin in 2011, 12, 13, and then the spread of the conflict in northern Myanmar into areas where the Ta'an National Liberation Army was operating. And then that, as almost all of your listeners will be aware, is when the in the teens, most visibly in 2015 in the battle for Koh Kang, where the Brotherhood came together, bringing together the Arakan Army, the Ta'ang National Liberation Army, and the MNDA, the Myanmar National Democratic Alliance Army. So, since that period, I've been following and writing on conflict initially in northern Myanmar, but then very clearly since 2015, 2016 in Rakhine, where over those years the AA was infiltrating and building up its forces, through until the coup and where we are today. So that's pretty much the background to my whatever understanding or expertise that I may have.
Excellent. And we will be continuing in the framework of where you left off and looking at the nature of some of these ethnic resistance organizations, as well as the regions that you're talking. And the first question to kick this off, a recent development from when we're talking, is the announcement from WA leadership, a public announcement that they would halt weapons equipment and military facilitation and financial aid to EAOs, many of which were largely relying on their connections with the WA to be able to arm themselves, and that was feeding into their resistance efforts. And so the question with this is, how real, durable, and enforceable do you see this cutoff being in practice? Because in Myanmar, there's always what's being said and what's being done. And then the corollary to that is, if to whatever degree it is happening and implemented, how do you see that affecting the resistance efforts in the conflict?
Well, I think you posed the question extremely well, because we are in Myanmar and nothing is clear cut. That said, obviously, Chinese pressure on the WA goes back well before this announcement, to much earlier in the year, when they were told by the Chinese in no uncertain terms to cease supplying, specifically the MNDAA, but also by extension the TNLA and presumably the AA, with munitions. So this is not new. And I think there's a couple of things to be said. One is the fact that obviously this pressure has now increased. The Chinese are really doubling down on their desire to see the Naypyidaw regime successfully pushed through with some sort of an electoral process in December, January, and in place a civilian, quote unquote, government in power. So that's clearly the Chinese way forward. The role the WA have been playing as a commercial actor, as effectively the quartermaster for, first of all, the insurgency in the north in terms of the MNDAA, with which it has obviously long-standing relations going back to the days of the Communist Party of Burma, but also the TNLA and the AA. What has happened in the period since the coup has been that commercial relationship and the WA are nothing if not commercially driven and commercially minded, that has extended to groups, to Bama groups, and other groups, Karani, for example, in central Myanmar. So the WA have been playing a critically important role. Another point to be made, which very much relates to the way you've phrased this question, is the fact that this has been more than purely and simply a commercial enterprise, which has obviously made the WA a lot of money. What has been happening since the coup, and particularly in 2021-2022, has been an extension of Wa power in terms of boots on the ground, the United Wa State Army, beyond its areas of direct administration. In other words, moving from the east of the Salween into areas of Shan State west of the Salween. So, as you're aware, areas of war administration, we're looking at basically Special Region 2, which is the traditional area along a Chinese border on the far eastern border of Shan State with China, but also Military Region 171, which borders Thailand, and the two, as I'm sure your listeners are aware, are not contiguous. Anyway, they're both essentially to the east of the Salween. What's been happening since 2022 in particular has been movement of Wa troops, sometimes in their own uniform, but most often not in their own uniform, into the west. And that has involved very close collaboration with the SSPP, Shan State Progress Party, slash Shan State Army North, which has always been a sort of proxy of whoever holds power east of the Salween, be it the Communists or the UWSA. The Shan State Army North has always been closely allied with that and logistically dependent on earlier the Communists and now the UWSA. That in the mid-teens sometimes involved Wa troops operating west of the Salween, right along the river, when the Tatmadaw was pushing the SSPP hard, to points where they threatened to take heights overlooking the river and effectively enabling long-range artillery to hit roads into Pangsan, the Wa capital. So at that time, the Wa began moving troops west of the Salween in a purely defensive role for limited periods. What we've seen since the coup is an opportunity to essentially neutralize the RCSS, the Restoration Council of Shan State slash Shan State Army South, to neutralize them and to extend Wa power directly and by proxy much further west, effectively across Shan State, and now, interestingly, into Karani. And my understanding is there are Wa troops in TNLA uniform operating in Mogok, which is actually part of, it's a curious salient, geographically the Mogok salient, but it is in Mandalay Division. So, whoa, this is a big change. So it's very easy for the Chinese to lay down the law, and clearly the Wa are not in a position to challenge that too directly, because that might result in the lights going out in Pangsan and other Wa cities, given China's control over pretty much everything, internet, electricity, currency, blah, 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 blah. So that's all true. And I would expect that the Wa will become, at very least, a lot more circumspect in their interrelationship with other groups. But are they likely simply to sever relations and cease any sales of munitions and march home back east of the Salween? I find that difficult to imagine, because what has happened, the way this has played out since the coup, the Wa have become a critical player in the overall struggle for Myanmar. And I don't think that can just be switched off by diktat from China. It would be entirely wrong to see the Hua as simply Chinese puppets, Chinese proxies. That's an argument which is often made, but they're more than that. They run a state, as we know, the size of Belgium, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. They have their own interests and their own focus, and they've never been secessionists. There's never been any question of the Hua wanting to leave Myanmar to join China or attempt to be independent. That has never come up. So they see themselves as part of an unfolding reality in Myanmar. And what we're now going to see, I think, in the coming months, critically, is just how far they want to push the envelope in terms of maintaining relationships on the ground and commercially, which they've already built up. So, and I would add finally that it has not been lost on observers. I'm certainly not the first person to note this, that when they invited their allies to Pangsan and made this statement, they gave China, they did not spare China's feelings. They said effectively what the TNLA had said before them, that this is as a result of massive pressure from China. There was no attempt to couch this in terms of national stability and happiness and concord or anything like that. This was about Chinese pressure. And that tells you a lot about how under the surface they are smarting and they are not enjoying this. So that's not a clear-cut answer to your question, but nothing is clear-cut here.
That's incredible. And I think our listeners' minds might be spinning as much as my mind is now, because we went from a question of looking at a potential cutoff of Hua supplies to resistance forces to now looking at a geopolitical map of Hua expanded territory, with looking at the unlikelihood of them receding and stepping back from that. And so then this opens up a wider game, a game board that we're talking about. Certainly the resistance, where the Hua support to the resistance comes in. And you know, let's be clear, going back to what you said, this is not of a benign nature, or not of a nature of mutual aspirations, but of transaction and of doing business, but still support nonetheless from actors that have difficulty being, non-state actors that have difficulty being able to acquire what they need from their markets. The Hua have been critical towards that. But looking at both this question of a potential cutoff, what that cutoff means, how much it is, what will be cut off, what the delay is between the announcement and the supplies that are there now, and how that will come to play out, all of that to leave in one parking lot. And then another to come back to the answer that you gave, which was not, which was beyond the scope of the question, but then opens up a very important reality to look at. And that's where I would pose to you the same question that I posed recently to Patrick Wynn when I was having an interview with him about his book, Narcotopia, which was essentially a question of, what do the Hua want? This is what are they aspiring to? This is, as Patrick answered, as you may answer as well, this is not something that is totally clear, but it is, there may be some things that we can say within that, but the exact answer is yet to play out. But what is known, as Patrick pointed out, is that the Hua have an army of 30,000 troops. They that's bigger than, as he pointed out, bigger than the armies of Sweden or Kenya, just to put it in scale. You're talking about a state within a state. Patrick is very clear that he sees the Hua as really its own nation in many regards, even if it's not recognized by official international standards, many other ways that it is its own nation, even if it's not seeking succession or being able to be part of China. And so they are, but with this expansion that you're talking about, they're more than just a powerful player with a strong army. They are also a there's also a game board that they are now expanding into, a critical player that is leveraging different influences, but also not wanting to be anyone's puppet. So where do you go, and what do you think about all that?
Well, let me go back to the question of the arms cutoff. I don't think it's going to be a cutoff, but I don't at the same time want to give the impression that the Hua are simply going to sidestep this and it's going to be business as normal. Clearly, they are cognizant of Chinese pressure and they need to accommodate Chinese pressure. And that will have an impact, in my assessment, on the flow of weapons and munitions more generally into central Myanmar at a very critical time, and also further south and further west to Rakhine, which is another very important theater of operations for the resistance, for the AA, obviously, but for the resistance more generally. So I just wanted to put that caveat in. In terms of what do the WA want, I mean, I can't, there's nothing that Patrick has said that I would disagree with. The WA are, as we all know, a state within a state. They're not looking to leave that state. I think they have pretty much, well, I mean, one thing they clearly want, and it is an open question whether this would depend on a fundamental reshaping of political realities in Myanmar or whether this could be done in the future under a military-dominated civilian regime in a constitutional manner. But clearly, the most proximate thing that the WA want is the recognition of WA Bang, a WA state, right? WA state, in the same way that you have Kachin state, you have Shan state, they want WA state, right? And I don't think, and this is a, this will be one way or another a point of contention and perhaps violence, whether that necessarily, as the WA would like, implies the joining up geographically of Special Region 2 in the north and Military Region 171 on the Thai border. Because I think in the event of some sort of a dramatic implosion of the military regime in Naypyidaw, which is not looking particularly likely right now, but just let's play with that scenario, were that to happen, and clearly it was more more of a realistic possibility in the immediate wake of 1027, right? Back at the end of 2023, first half of 2024, is the regime going to fall, et cetera, et cetera. Were that to happen, then I have no doubt the WA would move well before breakfast and have the two parts of its emerging state as one part by lunchtime. So that would happen very rapidly. Whether the triangle command of the Tatmadaw stood in the way or stood back and allowed it to happen would probably be not make a lot of difference. It would happen, right? There's another scenario, which is that the Tatmadaw essentially prevails in the current conflict and that you have a civilian regime empowered with the Tatmadaw obviously pulling all the strings. And then there would be the question of, can this be accommodated through constitutional change? But that, in terms of your question, what do they want? That joining up of 171 and SR2, that is basic, that's fundamental, WA state. Beyond that, and playing into that question, is an issue which a lot, well, most of the big EAOs are now have faced and are now facing in a much more existential manner, is that, is it possible to trust the Tatmadaw? So if ceasefires are made, bilateral ceasefires between, for example, the Tatmadaw and the KIA, the Kachin, the Tatmadaw and the Karen, the Tatmadaw and the AA, the Tatmadaw and the TNLA, can those EAOs really afford to trust the Tatmadaw? And I think we all know that given their historical experience over many decades, in the case of the Korean in particular, more recently KNLA as a player, et cetera, et cetera, and the AAA. But I mean, nobody trusts the Tatmadaw, and they're quite right not to, because if the Tatmadaw has one overarching imperative, it is the Burmanization and centralization of governance in Myanmar. And the bottom line is, you can have a ceasefire today, but they're going to come back. They're going to rebuild, they're going to re-equip, and they're going to come back at you. So for all of these groups, ceasefires have to be a very problematic issue, because they simply cannot, and they know this in their bones, they cannot afford to trust the military. That question also applies to the WA in perhaps a lesser way, because the WA, by well before the coup, by the mid-teens, right? Let me back up. In the aftermath of the invasion of Kokang in 2009 and the outbreak of war against the Kachin in 2011, the WA and their little cousin, the Monglar group, Special Region 4, were alarmed at the prospect that they would be next on the chopping block, right? The Tatmadaw leadership of that time under Tan Sui and Maung A was clearly, they were done with Kin Yunt's regime of ceasefires, and it was time for the Tatmadaw's overarching vision of the future to be put back into action. So they were issued, essentially, with demands that they become border guard forces, etc., and integrate. And they all, or most of the big ones, refused. At that time, the WA were also part of that. They were alarmed at the prospect of becoming next on the chopping block. And then between 2012 and 2014, what you saw in a dramatic fashion, it wasn't particularly obvious, but it was something that I was very keen to track, was the WA rearmed. A whole new generation of weaponry, bigger weaponry, armored vehicles, more artillery, a new generation of surface-to-air missiles. There was a new generation of small arms. The WA essentially rearmed, and by 2014, 2015, had achieved an impressive level of deterrence. There was no way the Tatmadaw was going to come after them, right? The Tatmadaw had its hands more than full dealing with other groups on the ground. So the question for the WA, in terms of the longer picture, the longer game, is it in their interest to continue to stand alongside a revolutionary project aimed at bringing down the military regime in Naypyidaw, or do they feel confident enough that they can, having aided and abetted those fighting the regime in Naypyidaw, that's worth remembering, but do they feel confident enough to assume that the deterrence that they achieved back in the teens will hold into the future? Or would they see a danger that the Tatmadaw, once it's in 10 years down the track, it's not going to happen next year or the year after, but the Tatmadaw sooner or later would be looking to undermine the sweeping autonomy they have already achieved? So that is it's a fundamental question which most consequentially impacts the two groups that have most to lose here, and that is the WA, who already have achieved their almost total autonomy, and the AA, who are looking to emulate the WA model to achieve their almost total autonomy from Myanmar. And both of those groups will have to make that calculation. So in terms of what the WAR want, I think I've covered at least two of the key bases.
You mentioned this WA expansion and the way that it developed, first of a defensive nature, and then as it started to move a bit more in its expansionist policy. And I think historically we can look at whenever a regime of any kind is able to expand, it's hard to know when to pull back. If I think this is something in human nature that goes beyond just expansionism, but science, technology, so many other things, that if you see this with AI now, you know, the ability of humans to do something is sometimes very hard to pull back on and question the morality, the ethics, the advantage, the benefit of doing it simply because you can do it. And so I'm curious about where you see the possible extent of potential WA expansionism in two parts. One in being what they're able to do, where they're conceivably able to practically be able in this time of chaos, where chaos brings opportunities, where they're able to make that expansion possibly practically. And then the other part of looking at that question in terms of what is it that they, well, go back to what is it they want, but what is good for them? What is just because they can do it, does it mean that they would or that it would benefit them in the long run? But just looking at this question of once you start on an expansionist spirit, how far do you go down that line, and what are the conditions that come up to limit that?
It's a good question, and I would say that the WA have a history of being sort of wild headhunters, right? I mean, that's where they came from. So to that extent, they are perhaps somewhat lacking in the sophistication of ethnicities who have a long history of statecraft, right? This is not the WA, and in that sense, very different from, you know, the lowland Burma. That said, they've been playing this game for a while, and they're not entirely stupid. So what appears to have happened to date is that their expansionism, if that's what you want to call it, I'm not sure it's the right term, but I think what they're looking to do is to assert a primacy, an ascendancy across Shan state. And, you know, when I mentioned Mogok, which actually is in Mandalay Division, the reason for that is not because the WA have any illusions or dreams, fantasies of marching into Mandalay, let alone Naypyidaw. That's certainly not going to happen. Mm-hmm. But Mogok is the TNLA, right? And they have been intimately connected with the TNLA, set up an office in Pangsang, their capital, back in 2019, I think. So they have had an intimate relationship with the TNLA, which actually is very different from that with the SSPP, because the SSPP is Shan. The WA and the Shan traditionally have not been the best of friends, whereas the TNLA, the Palaung, are another hill tribe people. I understand there are linguistic similarities, so this relationship has become political. It's certainly logistical in terms of sale of munitions, and the TNLA, particularly at this time when they're on the back foot, see advantage in having the WA operate with them. So I think my point is that the WA's ambition is more in terms of an ascendancy over Shan state, which actually is not a bad thing for China's long-term BRI objectives. And, you know, that that's a whole question. Chinese policy, backing the regime, would it make more sense to back northern groups? That's a whole different kettle of fish we can get into later if you want. But I think, you know, from the WA's point of view, this is about relationships with groups in Shan State, mm-hmm. close relationships, intimate mm-hmm. relationships that allow the WA essentially veto power with lesser groups, including the TNLA, the SSPP, the PAO perhaps, and that has also extended, as I said, into Karani, where they have had links going back a long time, many years before the coup, rather than some bigger project of exerting a role in central Myanmar directly. I don't think that is on their agenda. It would be very foolish if it were. That said, whoever rules in Naypyidaw will have to be even more cognizant in the future of WA power than the Tatmadaw has been in the past. So, yeah, the WA have, if you like, emerged since the coup into not just a key player in terms of autonomy east of the Salween, but a key national player in terms of the influence that they can bring to bear through other groups in Shan State.
Mm, right. So many more directions we can go with that, but given the time constraints, we have to move on to the next topic, which is drones. So moving on then to look at the drones munitions race and how it has evolved. There was an initial resistance innovation that in those early stages, and we've talked to those early resistance leaders that referenced their growing development with drones and referenced the military at first seeing them as like little toys that didn't really have any bearing. And once they saw the incredible impact they did, then the regime skilled up. And in terms of what they were able to do, jamming devices, and how they closed the gap, especially since 2024. And so I'm curious what your take is now on the current use of drones from the resistance side, which is very varied according to which groups you're talking about, and what the military has been doing, and to what degree this is making a real influence on the battlefield.
Yeah, drones have in Myanmar become a critical factor, right? And as your question or as your introduction referenced, this emerged from the use of drones initially by PDFs from very late 2021 through 2022. Which was then picked up on with PDF help by the Brotherhood for 1027. And in 1027, the Brotherhood brought to bear remarkable coordination at the strategic level, but tactically the key to success was drones, the use of big hexacopters and quadcopters that had been tested out, if you like, by PDFs in central Myanmar. So that came, as we all know, as a horrific shock to the Tatmadaw and to Min Aung Hlaing personally. They didn't waste any time in reacting to that. So last year, they set up a Directorate of Drone Operations, right? So in other words, they put the whole question of drones into a central part of the order of battle, right? And that has been what has expanded ever since. So if you go back before 1027, the Tatmadaw's drone capability was essentially larger. Tsai Hung is the Chinese CH-3s and CH-4 four fixed wing platforms, which obviously by definition require the use of an airbase. They were used largely for reconnaissance, going back to fighting in Koh Kang in 2015, right? So they weren't new. But that use of larger Chinese drones was rapidly overtaken once the Tatmadaw had set up their drone force directorate by the use of a whole range of smaller drones, right? Some of them homegrown, but a lot of them coming from China, and not least benefiting directly, very directly, from Russia's experience in Ukraine, which, as we all know, has again become the drone war. So the Tatmadaw have been expanding their capabilities through 2024 and through 2025 in a remarkable manner, which would not have happened without logistical support from China. And I have no doubt, I don't have anybody telling me this directly, so I don't think I can go into print with it, but advisory support from Russia. I mean, it would be remarkable given Russia's experience in Ukraine, Russia's presence as a backer of the Tatmadaw in Myanmar, if the Russians had not been sharing their experience, certainly at the level of the directorate headquarters and conceivably in the field. That I don't know, but it is not beyond the bounds of possibility. So, yeah, I mean, there has been a revolution in drone warfare in Myanmar, which has essentially left the resistance in the dust, right? Given the resources and the advice that the Tatmadaw can benefit from. And I won't say it's a game changer. In my assessment, it's not, but it has become a critical element in the, I don't want to overrate this, but in the sort of the symphony of elements which the Tatmadaw are now bringing together to very significant battlefield effect. So we're talking, and this plays into the whole bigger question of the Tatmadaw, which is almost certainly worth discussing. That symphony or that concert of capabilities involves clearly manpower, right? So at the same time as the drone capability has been expanded, we've seen since the beginning of last year and the conscription law, we've seen a dramatic increase in Tatmadaw manpower, which has been reflected on the battlefield. So you've got manpower, you've got air power, both drone and fixed wing, and you've also got a much more effective use of artillery, right? Not least multiple launch rocket systems, which initially were either totally absent, or if you go back to the beginning of 1027, were bungled badly. That's not now the case. And a lot of what's been happening in terms of Tatmadaw advances, and I'm thinking particularly of the months-long advance on Nangchou on the road between Mandalay and Lashio, which the Tatmadaw finally captured, I think, in July, if memory serves. Yeah, July. That brought all these elements together. More manpower, effective use of air power, effective use of artillery. And you put all these things together, and the Tatmadaw are now in a dramatically different place compared to the height of 1027, when the resistance was moving into Mogok and effectively on at the gates of Mandalay, right, in July of 2024. That, and one still hears reference in the Myanmar media to all these desertions and defections, and the Tatmadaw have lost half of the country. And some of that's true. A lot of it is not. A lot of it is basically wishful thinking. But if you look at it in terms of Tatmadaw, and also not just the capabilities, but the morale that those capabilities have the morale that's emerged from those capabilities, we're looking at a very different military machine, dangerously different in terms of what the resistance can do. And I mentioned Naucho, but by the same token, you can see these things playing out on the Karen, in the Karen theater, what's been happening in recent days on the Asian highway to Mirwadi, what's been happening around Pakant, what hasn't happened in terms of Ba Mo not falling after 9 months of siege. The Tatmadaw are on the move, and that has real implications, which arguably we should discuss before we finish, as to the coming months.
Those are some heavy words, and it's touching into a growing pessimism that we're hearing from other analysts more and more these days of the changing battlefield conditions, as well as, if we want to get into a wider subject, the changing world order and where Myanmar and the military fits into that. It's interesting that you mentioned this thing of morale, because to come back to that in particular, in the nature of this overall pessimism you paint, I recently did an interview with Mimi Winbird. The focus of that conversation was morale. I know that you're already familiar with her argument of that the morale of the resistance is of such a nature that that it's being discounted by some analysts, and in looking at some of the battlefield, so you could say losses or depressing news that come from military advances, her argument is that it's not taking into consideration what she said at that time, and we can debate this, but in her words, the incredibly low morale of the military, which contrasts with what you just said, but the incredibly high morale and motivation of the resistance forces, which is willing to really do anything it takes to in her views, to be able to have plan B, C's, and D's, because there's no other option to go back. In the conversation, we referenced Defeat and Victory by William Slim, World War II, and how a large part of that book, after they got their butts kicked initially by the Japanese and they were in India, an amazing feature of that book that struck me is that you would think that so much of that book would be on military tactics and strategies and battles and such. A large part is on Slim's work to improve the morale of the Allied troops and feeling that the Japanese were these superhuman monsters that they had no chance against. So a large part of his strategy to come from India back into Burma was to set up small skirmishes that could be small wins that could start to improve that morale. So this morale piece, really matters when it comes to looking at what's happening on the battle.
Mimi is a friend of mine, and I respect her judgment very considerably. And I don't want to paint this as a black and white thing, right? Morale is collapsing on the resistance side, and the Tatmadaw are beating their chests and looking to take scalps. Morale by definition is an incredibly opaque and complex phenomenon, right? Morale differs from unit to unit, from day to day, from man to man sometimes, right? Depending on a whole range of variables. So there's no black and white picture here. But what I would say in terms of Tatmadaw morale is you are looking at a machine which is still very much an operating machine, right? With an integrated command and control structure, with a strategy. It's an army, right? In the way that the resistance, clearly by definition, is not. And I think in the upper echelons, what has happened as a result of what we're now seeing on the battlefield is well, the upper echelons and going down to the level of the, you know, the officer corps more generally is a rebounding of morale, if you like, which after 1027 must have been in the pits, right? And now it's not in the pits. They're coming, they're climbing back out, and they have good reason to. That said, there is another part of the Tatmadaw, and nobody has the real insight, including people in Naypyidaw, for that matter. Nobody has the real insight to know how the reinforcement of the Tatmadaw by at least 70,000, 80,000 new conscripts, how has that played into that, right? Now, clearly, the conscripts are not forming, they're not forming units of their own, which would be very subject to potentially collapse and desertion. They are being used to reinforce understrength battalions. And maybe, we don't know, but there are reports that they are being sort of pushed out in front as cannon fodder and are taking heavy losses, which is obviously not good for morale. So at that level, it's not clear. So the point that I'm making is simply that compared to where they were in mid-2024, where they are now towards the end of 2025, when I say they, I mean the Tatmadaw generally, they're in a very different mindset, right? Regardless of how many wretched conscripts are being mown down in the field today. On the other side, I would agree with Mimi that I don't think that we're not seeing a collapse of morale on the part of the resistance, far from it. I think there is an awareness that strategically they are facing serious problems, right? Both politically in terms of what's been happening on the, what will be happening in terms of elections, and also strategically in terms of what's been happening on the battlefield. And I think that has probably, generally speaking, generated a sense of get up and go, right? I think, I don't want to misquote you, but I think you were talking, or the term has certainly been used that I've heard in recent days, they've got nothing to lose anymore, right? And I think that is a really important factor. Mm-hmm. And it begs a larger question. And the question is this: before Min Aung Hlaing gets to stage his elections in December, are we going to see a major attempt by the resistance in a more or less, probably less, but maybe that doesn't matter too much, a more or less coordinated, concerted fashion to hit back hard everywhere? Right, in order to derail, perhaps. My own sense is that elections will happen, come hell or high water, but discredit and perhaps derail the electoral process. And I think there's a very good chance of that. And to the extent where some groups may feel they have their backs to the wall, this raises the question of, and I was reading something along these lines yesterday, are we moving into a period of the war in which China has clearly thrown in its lot, its full weight behind Min Aung Hlaing's project? Right behind the military, behind the military's project for stabilizing the country or further destabilizing the country, for better or for worse. They're locked into that. Is that going to translate into a movement on the part of the resistance towards, and there's no pretty way of of saying this, of targeting Chinese interests and assets, right? A letter from the NUG's foreign minister, Zima Ang, to the Chinese government, basically saying, look, it would be wise not to recognize the validity of this electoral process, to pull back from support for the Tatmadaw, who do not represent the Burmese people, et cetera, et cetera. In other words, yet another appeal from the NUG for the Chinese to, quote, get on the right side of history, unquote. Apparently in complete disregard of ground realities. I mean, you know, if she hasn't woken up to the fact that the Chinese are where they are now, is she ever going to wake up to that fact?
Yeah.
So I think there has been a lot of frustration over that letter, which sort of underscored the NUG's distance from ground reality, and the possibility that in the coming months that could translate into events which would in some way shift the board, change, not overturn the board, but shift key elements of the board, because then were that to happen, and I'm not saying it will, but it seems to me we're definitely moving in that direction, were that to happen, what would the Chinese reaction be? The Chinese have always been very firm with Min Aung Hlaing. You need to protect our people and our interests. And that I fully can understand. They've had the same approach dealing with Pakistan, right? Where you have a sort of similar approach of the CPEC, the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor, which sort of mirrors on the other side of the Indian subcontinent, CMEC in Myanmar, right? The Chinese approach to the Pakistanis, and particularly the Pakistani military, is shape up, look after our people. And in Pakistan, they're dealing with a large, highly professional army, right? In Myanmar, they're dealing with something of a shambles when it comes to the Tatmadaw. And this is a group they don't have much trust for, which is, of course, reciprocated from the Tatmadaw side as far as the Chinese are concerned. So it's a very different dynamic. So were the Chinese to find that their interests and, you know, I have to use the P word, pipeline, right? There's a pipeline, a Chinese pipeline, that fuels a lot of southwestern China running right across battlefield areas, right? You know, from the Chinese perspective, this is not a good situation. And if the Tatmadaw fail to safeguard that asset and others, including personnel, then what would China want to do? Would it be in a position to, I mean, I'm not suggesting, and I would never suggest Chinese boots on the ground. I don't think it's ever going to happen. The Chinese are much too smart to do that. But what else have they got? They've got private security companies, which are still at a very embryonic level in Myanmar, right? This is not a serious military force that's already in the field. And they got the Tatmadaw, which, for all its advances in the last year, is still, as I said, something of a shambolic organization. It puts them in a really difficult position. And I don't, you know, I'm not saying this will happen, but it's something that if you're sitting in Kunming or Beijing, you really need to worry about. And I'm sure they are.
Going back first to the Zima Ang letter, I think that highlights such a kind of alternate reality we're seeing the NUG operate in terms of believing in a rules-based international order that has moved on and changed, and that an incredibly naive belief that has not matured or been learned from, that in adaptability and understanding the way to navigate the actual situation. Just a comment and reflection on that part of it. The last part I'd like to close on, the last question I'd like to ask is this question of overstretch, and overstretch where it occurs on both sides. On the side of the military, you mentioned the 70,000 new combat troops that are in their favor. In past interviews that we've done, it has on the other side, it's been pointed out that the simple challenge of supplying military troops in what, you know, they're occupying forces. And so even if they retake a territory, they are still seen as occupying forces. Being able to retake a territory and then hold on to it are two separate things. And there are lone outposts in some areas where just simply they're seen as such hostile enemies by the surrounding population that just simply supplying those outposts, at least in past years, I haven't heard an update on this, but past guests and analysts have expressed that concern. On the side of the resistance, you know, there's the WA cutoff, potential WA cutoff, we can say, as well as looking at ammo burn rates, the drone attrition under jamming, cross-group logistics coordination, other factors that could be playing into overstretch on the side of the resistance. So I'd like to get your thoughts on this as we close out the interview, to get your thoughts on where this overstretch is playing out on both sides.
Well, you pretty much answered my question for me, because it is playing out on both sides. I mean, what strikes me from the point of view of the Tatmadaw is you've got to wonder how long, even with the additional manpower, which doesn't necessarily translate into great combat effectiveness because of the nature of the conscripts, and their willingness to die or otherwise, you've got to wonder how far, how long and how far the current operational intensity, which is something we haven't seen since the beginning of the war, can be sustained, right? So, you know, the thought that's been in my mind is, Did Naypyidaw kick this off too early, right? Can they sustain this level of offensive operations, which, of course, assume their own momentum, most obviously on the road to Lashio, right? So they've taken Nangcho, they've taken Jiaomei, they've got it, now they're going to be sucked into and want to take Sipor and finally link up with Lashio. So there is this sort of momentum effect which takes them further and further down this overstretch road. And yeah, we're now in mid-September, effectively. So and elections aren't until December. So you've got to wonder, are they setting themselves up for a situation where come November, early December, the resistance comes back at an army which is exhausted and overstretched, right? Even granted, as you pointed out, the extra 70,000 troops, right? Now, that possibility is to a degree mitigated by the fact, and maybe the Tatmadaw strategy is specifically aimed not just taking back territory, constituencies, and key economic routes, but also exhausting resistance ammunition, which is their greatest vulnerability. It's not morale. They've got plenty of morale. They're not short of guns. But if you don't have enough ammunition, then you're in trouble. So if these offensive operations, which we're seeing all over the country now, are exhausting those supplies of ammunition against, as you pointed out in the question, a situation where supplies from the WA and the northeast of the country generally will be declining, if not cut off, but certainly declining, then does the resistance have the capability to launch that big push, if you like, closer to the elections? And I don't know the answer to that. It's right up in the air. And I don't think the belligerents have the leadership would have a sense of that, and therefore can try and do their best, and I'm thinking particularly the resistance here, to mitigate against that, right? Not to expend all their ammunition in the current fighting, but to, if you like, keep their powder dry for later in the year. Maybe, I don't know. I mean, when you're under fire, you're gonna fire back, right? You're not gonna be counting your bullets. So that's a wide open question. And you know, I would say in conclusion, something we haven't had time to discuss and which is definitely worth bearing in mind is my take has been over the last at least month or month and a half that a lot of what we're talking about is going to be impacted by what happens in Rakhine State and particularly what happens in Jiaopu. And if the AA and their allies, and they have quite a large number of smaller allies, if Jiaopu were to fall, the impact on the conflict, both politically and militarily, and by extension, logistically in other parts of the country, would be very considerable. And it's also worth throwing in the word diplomatically, right? If the regime loses Jiaopu to the AA, that automatically implies a very significant recalibration of China's dealings with the regime in Naypyidaw, which will not be to the advantage of the regime in Naypyidaw, clearly. And it gives the AA a position and a credibility as effectively an international player, mm-hmm. which is, if you like, more high profile than where we started off talking about the WA, right? The AA controlling a seaport like Jiaopu and those pipelines, the terminals to those two pipelines will be in a very new and more powerful situation. Your questions have covered a whole range of I think, issues which are currently important. And yeah, I think at the risk of stating the obvious, by the end of January, we'll be looking at a very different situation. And it's not clear whether that very different situation will favor the military's project in Myanmar, or as I think many of us would hope, the resistance's project.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to this episode. As regular listeners know, we often remind our audience about our nonprofit mission, Better Burma, at the end of a show. Truth be told, fundraising is hard work, and I can personally attest that it's no fun at all to keep asking for contributions. But the reality is, the situation on the ground continues to be distressing, and our work would simply not be possible without your support. What helps us most at this time are recurring donations. This provides our team with a reliable foundation, and it helps to reduce the stress of this constant fundraising. This also allows us to focus more energy on creating impactful content for this podcast, as well as to better plan sustainable humanitarian aid to vulnerable populations. Even a monthly pledge really helps. Like, say, gift us the equivalent of, a cup of coffee each month, or consider us a streaming service that you subscribe to. Anyway, to support our cause and make a lasting impact, visit insightmyanmar.org/donation.
Yarananda, 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 Yarananda,